today on Code Pen Radio.
Hey everybody, it's time for Code Pen Radio. This is episode number 191. And this week we're going to be talking about a topic that I think everyone in the Code Pen community has at least some experience with. We're going to be talking about debugging your code. And to talk about that with me today, I have our newest engineer, Cassidy Williams. Hey, Cassidy.
Hello.
Hey, Cassidy. Cassidy, of course, is also a rising radio star. This is her third episode.
I've been told I have a face for radio. Let's
Oh, come on. That's my line. What are you doing?
Dang it. I'm sorry.
So Cassidy and I are talking about debugging today in kind of two different ways. We're going to talk a little bit about debugging your code on CodePen. And also just debugging in general, you know, debugging when you're working in a production site. We have a couple of resources to share and a couple of ideas, and let's kick it off. I was talking about recently with someone who had trouble with a pen about all of the new things, or not new things, but all the little things that you can do to debug a pen and like figure out what's going on with your front end code that are actually like built right into the browser or actually built right into CodePen. One of the things that I realized is kind of new information to beginning developers is that the JavaScript console can help you even if you're not actually using JavaScript. And I have a couple of examples there. One thing that can happen is, let's say you have a resource coming in from a CDN and all of a sudden it's not working anymore and you don't know why. If you check out the JavaScript console, you can see, oh, like that resource is having an error. Maybe there's a 404 error or something going on there. You realize, oh, okay, it's not working because it's not there. You got to check the URL or maybe find another source for the resource. And that is surprising to people who are just working with HTML or just working with CSS because they don't expect that the JavaScript console would ever help them. I kind of sometimes think maybe they should call it something else instead of JavaScript console in Chrome.
Yeah, I almost call it the developer console more often now because I use it for so much more than just JavaScript. Yeah, the one thing that I use it a lot for is if I'm not using JavaScript and I'm just doing something with CSS, if I can't actually find something I've made because I have some wonky like positioning or something, I can go into the inspect element and kind of just like find my element and see where it's highlighted in the browser. And so I can say, oh, it's actually behind this element or way off to the left or invisible or something. And that's a good way of just like finding where your things are if you're doing something very layout specific.
You're right. Yeah. Inspect element is kind of goes hand in hand with the JavaScript console and is another kind of hidden feature, especially to newer developers. Because you don't expect that if you're not using JavaScript or if you're just getting started, that it's like serious enough to need that. And it's you could find a lot of information out about what's going on with your code just from that right there. Another thing that I thought is worth mentioning, and I've actually been able to catch people's bugs for them with this one, is the syntax highlighting. And I wish it was like more obvious, like how the syntax highlighting for things is determined. Like, I think sometimes you just look at it and you're like, why is everything a different color? And there's not a lot of good resources for why like different parts of what you've written are in different colors, but it can be very useful for figuring out where you've made mistakes. If you have an unclosed tag or something like that. It's number one is unclosed tag is where you get caught with the syntax highlighting. But also in things like JavaScript, you can, have something that you've defined or you think you've defined and you realize it's not coming up and you're like, what's going on here? Oh, it's not the same color as all of my other functions or all my other variables. And that's a powerful hint that that your syntax highlighter is trying to give you.
Yeah, especially if you're doing a lot of JavaScript and you have callbacks upon callbacks and just a bunch of curly braces and parentheses all over the place. It's really nice having those highlighters where you can figure out, okay, which curly brace matches up with which parentheses matches up with this, so that we can kind of contain where the problems are coming from.
It is funny because like I was saying before, I kind of wish that there was more information about why everything has a certain color, because we do have people who write in and they're like, why is everything all different colors? Is it just like for looks or to just like look cool. And it's like, well, in a way it does look cool. And, yeah. and you could spend a lot of time with customizing your syntax highlight, like on CodePen even. We have a whole bunch of different colors. But yeah, it has a lot of information that really clarifies what you're writing. And once you get used to using a particular syntax highlighter, I think it makes it a little bit easier for you to recognize the problems. If you're familiar with how things look in the one that you use all the time, the problems will start to stick out. So it kind of takes a little bit of practice, but you'll start to be able to rely on that a little bit more as you grow as a developer.
Yeah. When I first learned how to code, I didn't have any syntax highlighting at all. I was learning Java in Notepad++.
Oh, wow.
And then, yeah. And then and that was in my first like computer science class. And then before that, it was just me experimenting with web stuff in Notepad. And the highlighters today are fantastic. And they're so great for figuring out, like, is this thing actually a variable? Is this thing matching up with that? Is something being called or not? It's a great tool if you know how to use it.
Somebody needs to send me, if you know of this, if you're listening and you know of like a history of syntax highlighting or just anything that explains this stuff a little bit more, I'd really love to read it because it's mysterious to me and I think it's worth knowing. And of course, on CodePen, in addition to things like the console and syntax highlighting and all of that, we have built-in error messaging for anything that would give a compiler error. You'll get like a little exclamation point in the lower right corner of your panel. And if you just click that, it'll tell you exactly what the compiler error is. And that's really helpful for debugging things like Sass or Babel or anything that's running through a compiler. It'll just spit out the first error that we got there. Now, fixing that error doesn't always fix everything, but it at least, you know, takes you one step along the road.
Yeah, that icon has saved me many, many times.
Oh, me too. It is one of my best friends.
This episode of CodePen Radio is brought to you by Jetpack. That's jetpack.com. It's a WordPress plugin, you know, for your self-hosted WordPress site that brings tons of power from the WordPress.com universe over to your, you know, your self-hosted site. So their massive hosting infrastructure and all that. But it's not just about the power. It's just, it brings like this wealth of different features to your site. So, you know, backups is one of them that we've talked about. Social media integration is one we've talked about. I just used a feature of Jetpack just the other day that I had never used before, but I found it to be tremendously useful in the moment. One is that, like, I just had a movie sitting on my desktop. You know, I record little movies all the time for something to, like, just explain a bug. Or at CodePen, we use little short movies to post to Instagram and to post to social media of people's interesting work on CodePen. Anyway, I all the time have little video clips that I want to use for something, and they vary. Sometimes you shoot a really quick clip, and it's tiny. It's like 800 kilobytes or something, which for a video is really small. Or sometimes it's like 15 megabytes or hundreds of megabytes or something. You might know that on a self-hosted WordPress site, there has something to do with your host and your PHP settings and all that stuff. There's like a maximum upload size for images and video. And if you drag something too big on there, you just get like a warning in WordPress. It's like, that's too big. You can't upload that. It's above the setting that we allow. And that's fine. It's just that, like, okay, if it's a big image, find somewhere else to host it or shrink it down. It's just kind of a warning. Maybe you can get around it by making it smaller. But if it's a video, maybe I'll put it on YouTube or whatever, but like, what should I do? Make it unlisted, and then there's that whole rigmarole for uploading it there. No, Jetpack brings like WordPress.com video hosting, which is like super fast, has a really nice player. It's totally ad-free. They have their own WordPress video player, and you can just use it if you have Jetpack on your site. And there's, you know, the uploading limit isn't there. So you go into WordPress.com, open the media uploader for your site there, and drag and drop your larger movie file there. And then it's just automatically in the same media picker thing on your self-hosted WordPress site. So you're like, I was working on a Gutenberg site, and I made a new Gutenberg block for a video, uploaded on WordPress.com, but then picked the movie out of the image player there, and it just worked great. It just looked like every other video on the site. It's just that one was hosted on WordPress's servers with Jetpack's thing. It was great. It was just a nice little feature, and I was like, that works. I can use it because I have Jetpack. So thanks, Jetpack.
So another part of debugging, of course, is asking other people to help you out. And I think for a lot of people, that's possibly the hardest part of debugging because you have to tell somebody that you're having trouble with something. Cassidy and I were just talking before the show about the concept of rubber duck debugging.
Yes. Oh my gosh. It's such a great tool to have just something to talk out your problems with. And a lot of times, even if I'm working with friends, I'll say, hey, can I rubber duck you for a second? And just talking out the problem with someone or something, it helps you kind of figure out where the actual root of the problem is. And it actually works. I've solved countless bugs. I way too many times to count where it's just because I've talked it out verbally, because I had to start from the beginning, give context and figure out why the solution wasn't there just yet.
And that's, I think, the key of asking for help is actually giving context and explaining what you're expecting to happen with, you know, from the very beginning and with context of what you're doing. One thing that I see a lot of the time when beginners are asking for help is that they have a tendency to just say things like, it's not working, or, mm-hmm. I have a bug and I don't know what it is. And then if you take a look at the code, you see that it is working. It's just not, you can tell it's not doing something that it's, the person that wrote it is expecting, but it is doing what they wrote. And so there's kind of a difference there where it's like the code's not wrong in terms of having an actual output, but it's just not doing what you wanted. So, a good thing to do when you're preparing yourself to ask a question and ask for help. And I know this is very hard for people because people, I think, have a tendency to get embarrassed when they need to ask for help with code, which they shouldn't. Everybody needs help with it at some point or another. Mm-hmm. But you want to really be able to clearly state what you want to happen. And that, a lot of the time, like you said about rubber duck debugging, can actually help you find the solution before you need to go to anyone else. Because if you start to go through it in order and say, it's supposed to do this, I did this, this, and this, and this was the result, you're beginning to pick apart the bug in the way that the person who would solve the problem would do.
Right, exactly. And I think that's a good rule of thumb just for writing out questions too. Like if you ever go to Stack Overflow or something and want to know how to solve something and have a question you want to ask the community, it's a great way to format your question by giving full context. Don't just say, my program doesn't work, here's all my code, go.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants to deal with that. You need to say like, okay, here's the problem, here's what I want it to do, here's what it's actually doing, here's what I've tried, help. And that's the best way to ask questions and for help from both humans and also the robots that live on the internet.
Yeah. Well, we have our Spectrum community now where people are talking with each other and helping out each other with their pens and front-end type questions. And I have seen people get really, really fantastic answers by creating a small version of the question that they're asking, a reduced test case, where you just, mm-hmm. you take the thing that you're trying to hash out and put it into something like a pen, and you just remove everything that isn't part of the problem and just show exactly the one small thing that you're working on. People can really jump into that and help out a lot faster and often a lot more effectively because it's such a small case, and yet they're not having to pick through line after line of, your CSS or your, a ton of different images or all kinds of different things that have nothing to do with the problem. Reducing it down to the bare bones and the minimum that shows the problem is a really great way to get help.
Right. And that's also the best way to actually write tests too in your code, where eventually when you get to a more advanced point where you're not just asking questions, but you're actually writing tests for your projects, you want to make sure that you have that reduced test case. This is very buzzwordy, and have every single small test case that covers one very specific thing without any extra superfluous things. And then you kind of add those on later. And that's how you get a really thorough test suite.
Yeah, you were mentioning before we started the show, to me, the concept of test-driven development. And that is obviously a more advanced step, but I think it's time to talk about more advanced debugging. So,
yeah.
You want to tell us a little bit about that? That sounds to me like almost like the way to code without bugs. So obviously, this is something that everyone needs to know about.
Oh, yeah. My code is completely bug-free. So one thing that I really like to do is test-driven development. And it's much harder to do for front-end tasks just because it's much more UI-based rather than like getting a correct response. But for example, when I'm doing more back-end-oriented or API-oriented code, writing all of your tests before you actually write the feature is great practice. Because, for example, at a company that I was at way back in the day, whenever I was told, okay, we need you to write this endpoint that exposes these elements in the database, you just write out all the tests for if it returns nothing, if it returns a large list, if it returns this, if it returns that, and just put in the expected behavior. And initially, all the tests will fail. But as you start actually writing the feature, you start getting little green check marks on all of your tests as they slowly start passing more and more. And then when all the tests pass, that means your feature's done. And that's just it. And it's so satisfying because you kind of get that like just green overall, yay, you've finished your feature by kind of debugging it first before you actually write everything out. And it's kind of a backwards way of thinking when you first start out, but when you get used to it, it doesn't make sense to write code any other way. And when you're writing more functional UI components and stuff, there are elements of test-driven development that you can write. If you have a solid test framework at hand, you could say like, okay, I want to make sure that these components render, and when you pass in these sort of parameters, this should happen. Writing out those tests first and then writing the components saves so many headaches down the line when you're trying to figure out how to debug something.
Interesting. Yeah. And I guess it kind of helps you make decisions about how you're going to approach writing the code in the first place, right? I mean, if you have tests that you know you're going to need to pass, that seems like it would help you organize your thoughts ahead of time. I like that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. A lot of times when I'm building a feature and I'm not doing test-driven development or TDD, when I'm just writing the code, I tend to kind of just make it work and then clean it up later. And so it ends up kind of being messy and gnarly. And I'm just like, okay, well, I'll throw in a few log statements here, make sure all of this works as I get it done. And then you have to deal with the whole cleanup. But if you write your tests first, then you can't really afford to make it messy first and then clean it up later. You kind of have to initially write it clean. And yeah, kind of like you said, it's a good way to keep yourself in check and keep things written the way they're meant to be from the get-go.
Although writing messy code does give you a lot of a chance to build your debugging skills.
That's true.
You're going to write yourself a whole bunch of bugs.
Yeah, I was writing some stuff yesterday, and my goodness, I just had console log statements all over the place, figuring out where certain bugs were happening, which certain functions were running and weren't running. And yeah, that's probably not the best way to test your code, but it works.
Hey, you know, it's a great tool when you're getting started or if you've completely confused yourself throw some console logs in and get a feel for if things are working as they're expected along the way. There's also, I was reading an article from Sarah Drasner from, I think it's like a year or two now, but her debugging tips and tricks article, where she was talking about just writing debugger right into your code and pausing as you run it. And that I think is a very useful trick that you can just... like really just run through
tool.
Step by step and just see it happen.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, in the developer console, you can completely run your code step by step. So let's just say you have a website going and you know that there's a bug in it. You can just put the keyword debugger in your code with a semicolon. And what that does is in Chrome, when you refresh the site or your app or whatever you're building, it'll just stop rendering and stop running things at that debugger point. And then you have all of the traditional like tools that you would get for in something like a Java IDE or in a Python IDE or something, where you can step through your code, step into the code, and see everything run line by line in your code and function by function if you want. And it's fantastic because then you, with that, you can actually capture variables. Because, for example, if you just have log statements and your entire site is refreshed and you don't use this debugging method, you kind of just see only what's in those log statements. And if you want to check something later, you have to either run the whole site again or add some more logs and then run the whole site again. But by doing it this way, you get to capture the actual variable values as they change. And so if I have some global variable that starts at one value, but then when I refresh the site, it goes to another value, I can actually see where exactly that changed and kind of progress through the changes that that variable faces as you step through the code. And it's a fantastic tool. I highly recommend it. It can save you so many headaches.
And it's awesome because it's just built right into the browser. So you could use it on anything. You can use it on something you've already put out to production or something like, you know, a pen that you're just working on and just trying to figure out what the heck is going on. Why isn't this doing what I expected it to do?
Right. Especially when you're using a lot of multiple UI components. If you're using a framework like React or Vue or Angular or something where it's rendering multiple components at once, having that asynchronous nature checkable in this debugger is something that's just really invaluable. It can save you so many headaches in the long run.
Now, one thing I think that you've probably had a bit of experience with recently is debugging code that someone else wrote. And that's, I would imagine, a quite different experience, right?
Right, exactly. And debugging someone else's code, you never know. Sometimes I've gone into a project and I've been like, oh my gosh, this code is beautiful. Thank you. And then other times, oh boy, I have seen some things that no developer should ever see. My word. Especially back when I was doing some client work. Man, I had a lot of job security purely because some of that code that they hired us for was terrible.
Oh, and yeah. I've run into that myself in my old freelancing days. I would come along and clean up a WordPress install that went berserk or something like that. And you'd find some creative ideas.
Creative ideas is a great way to put it. And at that point, when you are given all of this code and you're just told, okay, it's not working, debug it. Mm-hmm. At that point, you just really have to know what is it supposed to do. You have already what it's doing and what the code is looking like. You just have to find out then what is it supposed to do and what are you allowed to change and what all does this code touch? And it really, it's kind of like, it's like exploring the jungle and all you have is a machete and you just have to figure out how you can like chop through all of this crazy code and figure out what you need to rewrite, what you need to delete, what you need to rearrange. And it can be messy, but it can also be really, really fun because then when it finally works, it's just the most wonderful feeling.
Yeah, it's legendary that working with legacy code is a tremendous challenge. And it is interesting to me to see how people work with that and kind of take an old thing and turn it into a new thing or break down bugs that have existed for a super long time in a system by right. taking a brand new approach or just correcting. I mean, I've seen situations where it was a 5-year-old typo getting corrected that fixed a bug. That it's amazing to me, you know, a new set of eyes on something can really just bring it back to a new life. And it's great.
Yeah, we were just as a dev team, we were talking about some of the changes we wanted to make. And we found this one area of the code that was from way when CodePen started. We did like a git blame where it tells you who edited that line last. And it was a line from 6 years ago.
Whoa.
That our co-founder Alex wrote. And we were just like, oh my gosh, this code has been here for 6 years. And that was the sign that we needed to change it.
Yes. Boy, I would not want to get a git blame that was 6 years old. I would just be...
Yeah.
You can't be held responsible for that anymore.
Right, exactly. In Alex's exact words, he was kind of just like, man, I don't trust my code from 3 months ago. 3 years ago, 6 years ago, oh no.
Every developer that I talk to says something like that, that they they would fire themselves from, you know, X amount of time ago. And often it's quite short. I mean, everyone just learns so much as they work and as they grow as developers that... Every single developer I've spoken to about, you know, looking back on their past work has always said, it's the worst. I'm so much better now.
Yeah. Looking at just at repositories I have on GitHub from, a year ago, 2 years ago, don't even get me started on ones that I have from college. I'm like, my gosh, why did I do that to myself and to the society? But I too don't know any developers who think that.
Yeah, I think Git Blame should have like a statute of limitations. Like if it's from 6 years ago, it just says a developer.
That's a good idea. That'd be kind of a fun Git plugin to write. Just say like, this is from my past or a ghost or something.
Yeah, you know, actually, I think GitLab has something like that. I noticed that GitLab, after someone leaves an organization, calls them a ghost user, which I kind of, I'm not real sure about that terminology, but hey.
It's kind of fun. I saw one open source repo recently where someone changed it from Git blame to Git props because just like, you don't want to blame people for their code. That's so negative. Give them props for their code. And I get that. At the same time, some code needs to have some blame.
I think the context matters a whole lot there.
True. Yeah, maybe you could add some machine learning to determine like if code is good or not, and that'll determine if it's a blame or a props worthy.
Oh wow. Yeah, that's a whole suite all of its own, isn't it?
Yeah. I'll write that down. That might be a project for another day.
Yeah, totally. I would like that. So I was mentioning at the top of the show we had a couple of resources to share. I had already talked a little bit about Sarah's incredible article from CSS Tricks, but Cassidy, before we put together the show, you noticed a thread on Reddit that was explaining, you know, the basics of debugging, and I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it was a great one. I just happened to be, you know, farting around on Reddit, and in the subreddit, Explain It Like I'm Five, there was a thread where it was one. A program or a game has a bug, how do you know how to find that bug? And it was something that I never really thought about from a non-developer perspective. And it was interesting seeing a lot of the replies. And I do highly recommend the thread. We'll have to link it. Because it was a bunch of people saying like, well, you know that every single program has an input and an output. When an output is wrong, it has to do with that input. And it's kind of just like following that path of all of the different outputs and inputs until you find the source. And it was interesting how people broke down how debugging works that way.
Yeah, it is. And I saw a lot of people mentioning that there is a science to it. There are tools that you can use, but there is still a bit of an art to it. You need a little bit of experience with the craft of debugging to actually, you know, have good insight and actually find the problems. And I think that actually, as you get used to it, as you get good with it, sometimes debugging is fun and you can build a skill. It's useful to share with other people. If you're known to be good at debugging, people are gonna know that and rely on you for that. And it could be a really valuable tool in the tool chest. So when you're running into bugs, which everyone on CodePen no matter how long you've been writing code, you're gonna create bugs for yourself. It just happens. You know, just think of it as a learning experience. I know it's frustrating, especially if you're on a deadline, but look at it as a learning experience and you can carry that with you in the future.
Right. And a lot of debugging, too, is just being really good at searching on the internet.
Like, yes.
People say, like, if your Google foo is strong, you are a great debugger. A lot of things that I do outside of work is I mentor at hackathons and programming events and stuff. And a lot of times people's problems are already on the internet. They just don't know how to search for them. And kind of building up that skill of knowing exactly what to search online is a whole other realm that we could get into.
Oh, absolutely.
Of just how to find solutions and figure out what's going wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. It working at really clearly stating your problem. Again, a thing that we talked about a whole bunch of times in this episode is that really clearly stating the problem will help you find the answer, either if you're finding it from other people, if you're finding it from your rubber duck, or if you're finding it in Google.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are skills that you can build.
Yes, they are. All right. Well, we will link up those two articles or article and also Reddit thread in the show notes. And if you have a bug that you're trying to work out in your pen, you should take it to our Spectrum community. It's spectrum.chat/codepen. And we have a whole bunch of people in there who would be able to take a look at your code and help you out. Just make sure to state it clearly and say something other than it's not working. You got to tell them what's really happening.
Yeah. It's a great chat. It's pretty active. I've really enjoyed lurking on there. I'll have to post soon.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a great community. Lots of very experienced developers and also a lot of new developers who are getting some chops and starting to help other people out. We've been very, very happy with how that everything's going over there. So drop in, say hi to everyone. So that's our show for today. Thanks for listening, everybody. And we will talk to you next week. Thanks for being on, Cassidy.
All right. Thanks for having me. Till next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
2 1 3 2 9 7 1 3 2 9 7 6 0 3 1 8 6